Good evening, everyone. So it is hot, and there's a saying in Zen Buddhism that goes, when hot, just be hot. When cold, just be cold. There's another saying, a little koan in Zen. Koan is the word koan is very famous in Zen. Often people in the West think it means an unanswerable question or a spiritual question which the Zen master poses, and the student addresses that question, grapples with it, reflects on it, is turned inside out by this question until finally there's some kind of awakening experience. But the word koan simply means a case, like a legal case. And it's a case, it's a particular event, the precedent that was set in the ancient times when, between a Chinese, usually Zen master, and a student. Can you hear me okay? No? Probably because you're so close to the fan. So there's a trade-off. Now you're welcome to move, or I'll try to speak louder. And there's a story, a case of a Zen master who's sick, and he's sick in bed, and I don't remember the story that well, but I think the Zen master was a master who was very famous for saying something like, every day is a good day. And he was sick, and so a student came to see him and asked him how he was. And his answer was, moon-faced Buddha, sun-faced Buddha. So now, that's the story, that's the case. And then you have to kind of figure out what in the world that's supposed to mean. He was sick, someone asked how he was, and he responded, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And the usual interpretation of the story is that the moon is something that lasts very briefly, and the sun is something that lasts for a very long time. The moon waxes and wanes and all that, and the sun just is kind of constant. At least in ancient China, the idea was that the moon is something that's very almost ephemeral, and the sun is something which lasts for a long time. And what he was saying by saying moon-faced Buddha, sun-faced Buddha, was that each one, whether is a Buddha, each one is complete in itself. And now that he was sick, he was being a sick Buddha. He was being someone who he felt his completeness, his wholeness, as someone who was sick. And if someone, if he was going to die, and his life was short, then he was living a short-lived Buddha, but he was still a Buddha, someone whose life was complete. If he got well and lived for a long time, then he was a sun-faced Buddha, someone who was a complete Buddha in living for a long time. And so the Zen masters are pointing to this possibility of feeling somehow complete, whole, a sense of well-being. Sometimes the Zen masters talk about feeling the perfection of the present moment, which is a challenging idea for some of us, but some feeling of some kind of attitude of being complete in the moment as it is. So when they say sun-faced, when they say, when it's hot, just be hot, they weren't saying suffer. They're saying, enter that world of heat. Be with the heat. Be present for it in such a way that you're not resisting it. You're not judging it. You're not pushing it away. You're not tensing around it. You're not lost in your story making how you're better off being in Hawaii, in the beach. You can be fully present for that experience. And you discover in that presence a capacity to feel somehow complete in that moment. To feel somehow that it doesn't need to be another moment somewhere else for you to feel whole, feel complete, feel at home in this life that we have. So at least in Zen, one of the things they're pointing to constantly is, how can you be at home right now? How can you be home in where you find yourself at this very moment? Some people will hear this and think, oh, well, that's a great ideal. And now I think what I need to do is spend the next 30 years in a Zen monastery to purify my mind so I can just be home in the present moment. And the Zen master then would just kick you out of the monastery if you came with that attitude. The idea is you're supposed to find something that's available to you, regardless of how much spiritual practice you've done. Some kind of way of being here in this moment in a way that somehow feels at home in this moment here. So when it's really hot, what does it take to feel at home in this moment? Some people might answer, oh, I have to figure out how I can like the heat. I could figure out all the advantages of the heat. I can figure out all the ways I'm saving so much money because I'm not paying to go to the sauna. And then you'll feel at home because you have a reason for it. But having a reason for feeling at home is not what the Zen masters are pointing towards. How can you be home in this moment as it is without a reason to be at home? And that's the koan, that's the quest of a Zen student, is how to find that. And in that quest, in that search to find that, what the person has to encounter is all the ways in which they don't feel home in the present moment. And this is one of the very important principles of Buddhist spirituality. That Buddhist spirituality has a number of ideals that the Buddhist practice is leading towards, a number of ideals that people like to live up to or live their life by. Certainly freedom, being at peace, being at home, being compassionate, being loving. There's a whole bunch of ideals that people have. But the Buddhists have. But certainly sometimes it's valuable to go there directly and kind of align ourselves with those ideals. But a healthier way or a safer way of attaining an ideal is not going after it directly, by doing it indirectly, by noticing, paying attention to all the things that get in the way of you fulfilling that ideal. So the ideal of being compassionate. Rather than being compassionate and forcing yourself to kind of be a certain way, artificially in a sense, you would pay attention to what are the barriers to compassion. When you're in the presence of someone who's suffering, is there horror? Is there fear? Do you pull back? Do you have anxiety? Do you get filled with problem solving? And the problem solving gets in the way of really feeling compassion? Problem solving isn't the same thing as compassion. Problem solving can be a way of trying to deal with our own anxiety in the situation. What gets in the way of the compassion? If the ideal is to be at peace, sometimes we can find it pretty directly. But what gets in the way of being peaceful? Are you ambitious? Are you afraid? Are you consumed with concerns about your self-image, how you represent yourself, how other people see you? Are you caught up in the world of social relationships, looking for the right relationships, trying to figure out how to have a good relationship or fix a relationship or all kinds of social, this whole social world? And be caught up in that, to be fixated on it, gets in the way of feeling at peace in this moment right here. So one of the principles of Buddhism is you don't go directly necessarily for the ideal. You have a sense of what the ideal is. And then you pay attention to what gets in the way. And then you resolve that, you work with that, you deal with that, you become very honest about it, so that it no longer stands in the way. So it no longer has this filter, or has this barrier, or has any power to influence your life as it is. Does that make sense? So to be at home in the heat, not to rationalize why it's a good idea to sit in the heat, what does it take for you? Those of you who don't feel particularly at home in the heat. Some of you might love it. So one of the things we're trying to do in meditating, I believe, or one of the potentials of meditation, is to begin exploring the territory of our minds, our body, our hearts, to see how we can be at home in this body, how we can be home in this breath, how we can be home in this mind, and not have a mind which feels off, which feels agitated or feels preoccupied or feels stressed. When stress is arising in our body, our mind, our hearts, it's usually an indication that you're not feeling at home where you are. So we begin to explore and discover how we can be deeply at home in the present moment, here as we meditate. And then there's a more difficult task of translating that or extending that into our daily life. How can we have that sense of being at home in the activities that we do? One of the great things that happened, one of the great kind of trainings I received in my monastic life was my teachers insisting that the work that I did had to be considered a meditation. So I had to learn how to be at home with the work that I did, how to be engaged with it fully, and not feel like I was trying to get the work over as quickly as I could so I can get on to more important things, because then you're not at home with the activity. But how to be engaged in it in a full way, I felt at home in it. When I was in a Zen monastery in Japan, I went to visit one of the cooks once in the kitchen to talk about something, probably just to chat about something. And the cook was chopping vegetables. And I asked my question, and he put down his knife and turned to me and responded very, very directly, completely. He just was there for me and responded. Once he'd responded, he picked up his knife and went back to his vegetables. And I asked another question. He put down his knife, turned to me, and was there fully for me and addressed me. And when he finished, he picked up his knife and started chopping his vegetables again. And I'm kind of slow, so I asked him a third question. And he put down his knife, turned towards me, and he said, very polite, very nice. But the gist of it was, I'm here in the kitchen today to chop these vegetables. And my practice is to engage myself fully in this one activity that I'm doing. And when I'm talking with you, I can engage in you, with you. But I have to go back and forth. I'm not going to be chopping while I'm talking to you. So, because that's not my practice. My practice is to fully be here for... It's a training to be fully present for this one activity. To be at home here with this thing. And we can go back and forth. We can continue this way back and forth. But then dinner's not going to be ready. And so then I got the message. And I got a teaching also. An example of how this Zen monk was engaging in being at home in this one activity of chopping his vegetables, and how what it was like to be that absorbed, in a sense doing just one thing at a time. So we try to learn to do this in meditation, how to be at home in the present moment. In learning to do that, we have to learn about all the ways we don't feel at home, all the ways in which the mind carries us away, all the ways in which we react to the present moment or other moments, someplace else, the ways in which we contract or try to escape, or all the different ways in which we don't feel at home with what's going on. We get to see that, and the reason why it's so important to see that is that some people think, well, spirituality is all about having peace and love and light and calm and whatever, all kinds of wonderful things. And you might be lucky some days and have that. It's really great. But if you have it too easily, you're not going to learn anything about yourself. And the idea is that in Buddhist spiritual life, is you want to learn about yourself. You want to learn what your reactions are, what your common tendencies are. You don't want to escape or find refuge or find a vacation in feeling good. You want to learn actually how you work, your mind, your reactions, your responses, your thoughts, your feelings. In particular, your reactions, how you respond to how things occur around you or within you. What's your relationship that arises when something happens? And learning about how you work then gives you a tremendous power to, in the future, to notice that coming, to see the arising of a reaction, of a response, and not give into it, not lose yourself in that. To have a gap between the stimulus and the response. There's a beautiful teaching that one Buddhist monk teacher who says the mind is like a committee. Or the mind is like a board meeting. And there's all these different board directors, or members, who, you know, are on the board, and they all have, they're very opinionated, and they have different opinions, and they have all kinds of different ideas, and some of them have crazy ideas, and some have conservative ideas, and all these ideas of how to respond. And you can't really know what the different board members in your mind are going to say at any given moment, how they're going to respond, what they're going to think, what they're going to feel. But you're the chair of the board, and you have veto power. So you're not necessarily responsible for all the ideas and thoughts and things that surface within you. And it's really helpful not to feel responsible for it. Oh, it's that committee member. But you are responsible about whether you pick that up and act on it. And that's why it said that you have the veto power. You can say, well, that's an interesting idea, but not now. Or, that's not a useful idea, it's not helpful. And I'm not going to pick that up. I'm not going to go along with that. So to be able to have... to know yourself so well that you see your reactions, see your responses, see that when someone comes up to you and, you know, maybe at work and says, you know, your work is not up to snuff. You know, you're not really good enough these days. Used to be good, but it's not good enough now. How do you respond in that kind of situation? That's a very powerful situation for some people. How do you respond? What's your reactions? What are the thoughts, the feelings that go on? If you're familiar with your... probably what happens is it happens very fast. A whole kaleidoscope of different feelings and reactions and thoughts and, you know, memories and images and planned futures and what this all means. And all this stuff happens very quickly. If you've learned to pay attention to yourself, if you develop some ability to be calm and present and engaged with the present moment, you can begin tracking a little bit some of those reactions and responses, and then be wiser about how you respond to it. And it's very useful. The more deeply you can feel at home in the present moment, the more likely you are to notice the reactions, how we react to what's happening. If we're already in a reactive mode, and we're constantly reacting and lost in our reactions, then one more reaction we're not going to notice, necessarily. We're not going to notice it's the shift, the change in the feeling tone of the body, the change in the feeling tone of the heart or the mind. But if you can begin finding yourself at home, you can notice the shift that happens and track it and be involved and engage in it and learn how to be the chair of the committee. Oh, let there be a gap before you respond. And in the hope that in that gap, you can learn how to respond more wisely. So rather than the habitual responses taking precedent, it's a considered response that takes into account the whole situation in a more wiser way. So rather than going along with what one committee member says, the whole committee has a chance to sit with it for a moment, and then a wiser response can come forth. This notion of a gap between stimulus and response, does that make sense to you? Now, does it seem reasonable? Do you have any reservations about appreciating or living in that gap, finding that gap?
No, it's interesting because in the experience during the sitting that essentially I felt really engaged and comfortable with the heat, and uncharacteristically so. You know, feeling the waves, and it's so dynamic and just all through my body. And so, you know, I had an idea, oh, it's like a blanket. And then it would just like flip, and the blanket would be smothering me, and I'd feel claustrophobic and almost panicked, you know. So it was just interesting what you said, this kind of reacting in this. It was very interesting to watch it. I just kind of try to, you know, back away from that and watch it, and it would subside, and I'd go back to the pleasant thing. So it just happened several times.
Beautiful. So one of the things she said was that, you know, she sat comfortably with the heat and noticed the waves of heat coming up, and then, but every once in a while there'd be this kind of flood of being oppressed by it somehow, and maybe bordering on panic. But then what she did was she just hung out with it, and it subsided. And that experience of learning how to hang out with the reaction that we have until it passes away is very helpful in a wise life. Because sometimes it can seem that our reactions to what's happening can be very compelling in the moment. A desire can be very compelling. I need to have that now. The desire wells up. The aversion wells up. Oh, I have to get away from that now. I have to stop that now. I have to change this now. Desires, aversions, fears, all these things can arise. And if you have the experience of learning how to hang out with it and not give into it, and see that it dissipates relatively quickly, if you don't fuel it and add into it, can be very empowering, very encouraging. So in the future, you're not seduced by it so quickly. It loses some of its authority. So other comments or questions? Yes?
I found that to be particularly true with anger. If somebody, often my husband, does something that really annoys me, I used to just automatically respond. And I've learned if I just pause, you're right, it's just that little bit of space that gives me the chance to choose if that's really where I want to go, or if that's the time I want.
Good.
Is that the same thing as counting to 10 before you get mad at somebody? How does it relate to that? I mean, that is, you know what I'm talking about. That's something you teach your kids, you know, sort of an old homily. And that, to me, means just stop before you do something. But it somehow seems connected, especially given the last example. I don't know, I'm just throwing that out.
It makes sense to connect the two. I think that it's very wise to count to 10 if you're really angry. Generally, I don't think it's very useful to respond to the world through anger. So anything we can do to take the authority the anger has away from it, anything we can help us kind of get out of the grips of the anger, so we can respond from a different place, I think is really helpful. And if it takes counting to 10, that's great. Sometimes that's not even good enough. So you might notice the reaction that the anger arises, and it might be that the only thing that chair can do to control the meeting, because everybody's angry, is to call for a recess, time out, and go for a walk, you know. Go for a walk for 10 minutes or something and come back. The gap between stimulus and response, when you're practicing, when you're very mindful, you know, it doesn't have to be more than that. It can be, you know, it used to be a second. It doesn't have to be this, you know, very intentional long gap. It's almost as if the mindfulness provides. When the mindfulness is very, very strong, it's as if mindfulness provides a permanent gap that's always there. I don't know how to describe it to you, but kind of a dramatic example of this, perhaps, that some of you maybe have experienced, is if you've been in an accident in a car, or maybe near accident, something really dramatic. You're on the freeway and you're going 70 miles an hour or 90 miles an hour, whatever you tend to do. And then, you know, some car just misses you by a hair. And, you know, you realize that you were just at the edge of utter catastrophe, you know, and you just barely missed it, you know, maybe death or something. And once kind of like the initial kind of moment has passed and you realize you're safe, there can arise a kind of a great stillness. Everything you were thinking about before has been wiped away. It's like wiping off the hard drive, right? It's been cleared out, erased. At least, you know, and there's a few minutes there where maybe before all the old concerns and, you know, things that seem so important at the moment, you know, there's a few minutes before they come back. You have a sense that there's more important things in life than what you're going to cook for dinner, or what, you know, your partner said, you know, or what you're going to do for your vacations, or, you know, much more important things in that moment where you realize you're still alive. And there can be a feeling of great stillness or silence around. Everything's still the same. You're still driving, and maybe you're still thinking a little bit, and you still have a body and this activity. But there's this wider context of stillness and silence that seems very tangible almost. Is it making sense to you? Have you had that experience sometimes? That's like having a permanent gap.
Did you ever read Emily Dickinson? After great pain, a formal feeling comes.
After great pain, a formal feeling comes. A formal feeling comes. What does a formal feeling mean?
Quiet, formal. What do you describe?
A formal feeling. Huh?
She's one of the
greats. Yeah, she's great. I love her. But I haven't heard that one. And a formal feeling. So other thoughts you might have, things you'd like to ask, but anything at all. Yes.
I like the idea of sort of standing beside yourself and watching what you do, learning that distance and becoming as much as you can an objective observer. Whereas in the heat of emotion or the heat of busyness and so on, and all this, is that I am in it and I'm doing it. But the ability to step aside and looking at yourself with some detachment, I think, is a wonderful thing.
It is. And in Buddhist spirituality, the idea of developing that capacity to observe is very important. And many people report they feel like the sense of being an observer becomes stronger and stronger. And the interesting shift is at some point as the practice goes along, that we realize that the idea that there's an observer is added on top of the ability to observe. And then the idea is to let go of the notion of someone who's observing and just let the observation exist free of an observer.
That moment that you describe, which seems really short, someone says, your work is terrible, and boom, there are the feelings. It's 1 second. What can you do? It seems also, or I've experienced it, that that moment is actually vast. I mean, it's a moment of freedom if you can be awake in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that it's the spaciousness that Shobyal Rinpoche or somebody talks about. It's this huge, vast field of possibility. Not having to do with how long it is in time.
Yeah.
It's a space.
So Marina said that in that moment where maybe your boss tells you your work's not good enough, and there's all these reactions, that there can also be a sense of kind of vast space or time in that moment. And I think that when the sense of observation, of mindfulness is quite strong, the mindfulness comes with a sense of, when it's quite strong, with a kind of sense of vast peace or spaciousness. And all your reactions might still arise, but you see them in a different context. And so you're much more at ease about them, or you're less likely to grab a hold of them. The analogy I like to use is that... Is that accurate enough? The analogy I like to use is for this is... If there's 5 people standing in a little elevator, you feel really claustrophobic. And then, you know, and it's like I can't do much and very reactive to the people and, you know. But if those same 5 people are standing inside of, you know, some huge, huge cathedral or huge, you know, sports arena or something, and they're all spread out, you know, from far away from each other, the spaciousness of this great cathedral, vaulted cathedral, you're not concerned about your physical space and these people being too close to you, and there's all this space around those people. So, you know, you can make yourself comfortable by getting rid of more people, or you can make yourself comfortable by making a big space to hold them all. And part of what can happen in meditation is we're making this great space in the mind that can hold everything there. And so things aren't the same kind of problem for us as they would be if the mind is claustrophobic. And if we're riding really tight and close on top of our fixations, our attachments, our clingings, our fears, our anxieties, then it's as if the mind has become very, very tight and small. And the domain of awareness is very, very small. As we learn to develop the mindfulness then will get stronger, and with that strength tends to come a sense of more and more space for these things to arise. So that's why I said that the gap between stimulus and response is not necessarily just a gap in time, you know, sequentially. There's also be a sense of, like, there's this great space that holds it all, that's simultaneous with the arising of things. And because you have all the space, you know, so you're in this big, big cathedral, and someone, you know, 50 feet away, you know, stretches out like this. And there's so much space that, you know, you're not going to react to that. That's okay. Whereas if you're in the elevator and you're constricted and something goes like that, you know, you're kind of like, gee, that's rude. So when the mind is all this space around it, the mind can have a lot of things can bubble up in the mind, and it's more okay to have it. You become more spacious about it. You're less likely caught by it, interpret it, make meaning of it. I know some people can be horrified by the content of their own mind. I can't believe that I had that thought. I can't believe I had that kind of feeling. And then, oh no, I can't let anybody know that I had that kind of thought. I can't admit it. I can't even admit it to myself, perhaps. And it gets very tight with that kind of anxiety around our thoughts. What mindfulness hopefully teaches us is that we don't have to be in this tight, reactive relationship with the thoughts that arise. And even if they're horrendous thoughts, there can be a spaciousness that, you know, holds them, that sees them, and you realize that you're safe because you don't identify with them. You don't say, this defines who I am. I am this kind of person. When you define yourself by your thoughts and your feelings and reactions and your body and whatever, any kind of identification that you hold on to is a way of making the space in your mind tighter. When you let go of trying to define yourself in some fixed way, holding on to definition, not defining yourself by anything, then you start making more space. Am I making sense? Yes? No? I like to hear no sometimes. You know, because it's a little bit reassuring sometimes if I hear a no. Because then we can, you know, try to clarify it. Yes?
The idea of being surrounded by all these people tends to make me gun shy. And I feel kind of uncomfortable with the idea of at least the total amount of presence there. And so there's a tendency for me to end up not coming on the events. But now, tonight,
So it's not a matter of making more physical space in the room, but more space in your mind. Do you have a question, Don?
Sometimes you have questions that you've got all the space, you know, and you're stepping back and you're still not sure what's going on. Put the knee-jerk reactions on hold and all that, and look at it and still confused.
So Don says that even sometimes you have all this lots of space and mindfulness to kind of really see what's going on. You're not getting caught up by your reactions and reactivity. And even given that, you still don't know what to do, don't understand the situation. That's right. Can you have enough space in your? Can you feel at home enough that it's okay not to know? Yes.
Can you go back for a minute to not identifying yourself with thoughts, with your mind? In absence of that, how is it that that we should hold our thoughts? The thoughts arise, the feelings arise, and in absence of identifying with them, how do we hold them?
Well, in meditation, you don't hold them at all. You leave them alone. You don't have to have any idea about how you're supposed to relate to them, any policy, any strategy, any, you know, context for them. Just let, you know, just leave them completely alone. Just be mindful of them, be aware that they're there. But you don't have to do anything about them. You don't have to assume that they're yours. You don't have to assume they're someone else's. You don't have to assume they're good or they're bad. You don't have to, you know, say they're, you know, just don't do anything. Don't hold them any way at all. Outside of meditation, you know, our thoughts are part of what helps orient us to how to live our life and how to make sense of things and the meaning of stuff and how to plan a day and all kinds of things. And then how to hold your thoughts. I have a wide range of ways in which I relate to my thoughts. All of them which are friendly. Most of my thoughts in a friendly way, regardless of what they are. But sometimes I think of my thoughts as being very useful and good friends, and I'll go for a walk and think about things, take up certain themes or certain things I need to think about it that way. Sometimes I find my thoughts very fascinating because they seem to arise sometimes quite spontaneously, and they seem sometimes an indication of deeper things going on inside of me, kind of like dreams can be. You know, you're like, oh, I didn't know, why am I thinking that right now? What's going on in a more deeper way? Why am I having this kind of fantasy right now? Why am I constantly thinking about how, you know, being in the beach in Hawaii? You know, oh, I think it's because I really don't want to be here. And so sometimes the tracking my thoughts helps me understand in a deeper way what's going on. But why are you asking the question?
I guess because I find that for me, the letting go of is easier if I have a sense of where it's coming from. And so that's the way I'm more likely to approach stuff, and that's what helps me to kind of step aside and be the observer of of what comes up.
Yeah.
And then ask the question, okay, so where's that coming from?
It's a great, I mean, it's a great, you know, way of studying it. What you might try doing is, in addition to that, is to look at something else. And that is, why are you holding on in the first place? So not necessarily why are you holding on to that particular thought, but rather, why do you have a tendency to want to hold on to thoughts? If you can understand that, that would be a great key. So for example, if a person is holding on to their thoughts because they feel insecure, and the thoughts are what, you know, gives them a sense of identity, a sense of security, a sense of something, then turning the attention back and looking at the insecurity and resolving it, then in the future there's no need to hold on to those thoughts for that reason anymore. So, you know, why are you holding on? It's an interesting exercise to look at.
Possibility of an observer, as you talked about the observer and then the process of observation that's going on. In my experience, not with thoughts, but more with feelings, that was mine, was that I found that by trying to be detached from them, I was really pushing them away.
Yeah.
But I was really good at it for many years, so it was only when really extreme sort of grief and fear of death kinds of feelings that I just kind of one day experienced it as a wave going over me. I'm grieving, you know, and that's what I'm doing. And just, I don't know if that was observing, it was more of just that's what I'm doing now. It wasn't, I shouldn't be or I won't be later or
if I had done this, it was just grieving. But the way, but the image that I experienced it as, it was a wave, like when you go kind of into the ocean and the big waves come, you have to just go down and go, the wave's going to go past. There's nothing I can do about it.
Anything else anyone would like to ask? Feels complete enough? So, okay. Thank you.